Traveling through the fields of her own country, Ruth found herself a widow in the midst of turmoil. Although she was in Moab, her family would have been nearby to help her. She chose to follow her mother-in-law to Judah. And thus, she took on not only the role of being a widow, she took on the role of being a foreigner. I have not spent much of my life in foreign countries. Probably I've been in 11 or 12, some for short periods of time, some for a little longer. Some of you have been in more. But no matter how long or short of time I spent in a foreign country, I always felt a little bit like an outsider. And it reminded me of the difficulty and frustration of feeling that way. There's just a sense of discomfort about being outside. And it seems like when that discomfort starts to close a little bit and you get a little bit more comfortable, something happens to remind you again that you really don't belong. You're a foreigner. Can both be humbling and humiliating. To carry around that thought, I'm out of place. I don't belong. Well, there's many great lessons from the book of Ruth, but one, and maybe a more subtle one that I think is there, is pointing out the reality of being a foreigner in a strange land. Long after those of us that have read the story and are so well acquainted with the story of Ruth, after she moves back to Israel, the writer of that book still calls her Ruth the Moabite woman. Reminding us that she always stood as a stranger in a foreign land, and she was probably forever reminded of that. And yet she was undoubtedly aware of being a foreigner as much as those around her were aware of it. But even though she was a foreigner, we have no hint that Ruth ever longed, or no suggestion that she longed, to go back to her homeland of Moab. Her words and actions in Judah were as steadfast as her initial vow to Naomi that we find in chapter 1, where she said, "Whether thou goest, I will go. Whether thou stayest, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God my God. Whether you die, I will die, and there I will be buried." The subject I have this morning is entitled Independence Day. Where is our citizenship? And I was asked to consider, where is our citizenship? Should we, or to what extent should we be thankful for that citizenship and its freedoms? And is our wealth a good or bad thing as far as our spiritual journey and our citizenship is concerned? Are you proud to be an American? Well, I think if I were to ask you in a way that you would be comfortable responding, you would probably say yes. It's not unlikely that we won't hear Lee Greenwood sing that song again in the coming week. It's become somewhat of a tradition. And while I think I would say I am proud to be an American, I'm not sure proud for me is the right word. Because being proud to me connotates that I've done something to deserve it. And I have done nothing to deserve to be an American. I simply happen to be born here. I've not fought in any wars, and some of you have. I've not defended our homeland like some of you have. And while I would not argue with the phrase, I am proud to be an American, I think a more appropriate, at least for me, and maybe for you, is I am grateful to be an American. Citizenship, immigration, hot buttons, aren't they? Very, very often when I'm in somebody's home, they will express very passionate views upon this very passionate subject. But not only citizenship in America, but heavenly citizenship is an important issue too, isn't it? And men debate what constitutes it. How is it achieved? How is it maintained? And while it's good to consider those things, to some extent they're irrelevant because God has already determined what constitutes it, how it is obtained, and how it is maintained. Regardless of what part of the world a Christian lives in, he is a dual citizen. Most of us, if not all of us, are citizens of the United States. I hope all of us that are at the age of accountability are also citizens of heaven. Paul using that phrase in Philippians chapter 3, verse 20, where we are called citizens of heaven. We are physically born into one. We are spiritually born into another. And for those of us that have that dual blessing of being citizens of the United States of America and citizens of the Lord's kingdom, we are doubly, doubly, doubly blessed, aren't we? Well, I'd like for a few moments to consider both citizenships with you. In spite of her grievous shortcomings, legalized abortion, budget deficits, pork barrel spending, courts rejecting faith expressions, diminished work ethic, this is still the greatest place to be in the world. The blessings of living in this country far, far outweigh the negatives. And the blessings go beyond wealth, and they go to opportunity. Opportunity for jobs, education, health care, hospital care, civil protection. And as citizens of the United States, although the Bible doesn't refer to the United States because it wasn't in existence when it was written, the Bible clearly says we have several obligations as citizens of the United States that we should cheerfully, I believe, carry out. Romans chapter 13 says we are to obey and support our governing authorities. And I think the only exception to that is the exception we find in the book of Acts where it says we ought to obey God rather than men. But if there is no conflict, whether we understand or whether we agree with them or not, if it doesn't conflict an ordinance of the Lord, we are to abide by it, be it trivial or be it significant. In that same 13th chapter of Romans, we are told that we are to pay our taxes. So I could, I think, pretty much sum up our obligation to our government as paying our taxes and obeying its laws. I would add one third obligation that I think we as Christians have for our government, and that would be pray for it. In James chapter 5 verse 16, we are told to pray for one another. I think the context there is in the Lord's family. But I think the principle within scriptures is that it's a good thing for us to pray for our country. And yet, despite the wonderment of our earthly citizenship in the United States of America, it absolutely pales in comparison to our heavenly citizenship. I don't know if any of you are James Michener readers or not. I used to be. I've kind of weaned myself off of it because his writings are rather tedious. He writes historical novels, and he always starts with the invention of dirt and brings us up to the present time. But in one of his epics called Hawaii, There is a lady, Nuxi Key, who longed to become a citizen of the United States. And in this particular scene, she finds herself in the immigration office in Honolulu. She has studied ad nauseum for the test she has to pass in order to receive her citizenship. More than anything, she wanted to become a citizen of the United States. But when the test begins, she becomes strangely silent. When the examiner asks her who the father of our country is, she says nothing. She's overwhelmed by the moment. She so wants to belong, but now she can about attain it, she's lost her tongue, Michener says. Finally, as the examiner asks her for the third time, she begins to speak, and out it pours. She names the capitals of every state. She explains the three branches of government. She describes the Bill of Rights, and she talks on and on and on and on. And finally, she triumphantly leaves the immigration building as a citizen of the United States. And as she comes home, she tells her family that when you are a citizen, the ground under your feet feels different. When you're a citizen, the ground under your feet feels different. Citizenship in heaven is a shalom peace. You're a citizen now of the nation of God. And everything from that moment on is to be different. Now, to say that it is to be different is not the same as to say that it is different. I hope that when each of us became citizens of heaven, we felt as exhilarated as this Hawaiian lady felt when she became a citizen of the United States, or certainly I hope we even felt more so. While we are to have dual citizenships, they are not equal citizenships. While our dual citizenship should be abounding and should be an abounding blessing, this dual citizenship is too often a dueling struggle for some of us or all of us. Mark chapter 10, verse 25. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. For everyone who stumbles because of adversity, there are 10 who stumble because of prosperity. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul exhorts us, or exhorts the rich, let me rephrase that, with the following admonitions. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17, 18, and 19. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in certain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. A very similar thought to what we find Jesus giving us in the Sermon on the Mount. Lay up not for yourselves treasures on earth, where wrath and moth and rust can destroy, but lay up your treasures in heaven. You can quote that verse as well as I can. Who is Paul writing to in Timothy chapter 6? He's writing to the rich. Now, who are the rich? The last time I looked at Forbes 400, my name wasn't on it. The last time I looked at the Forbes 400, your name wasn't on it either. you would have to have a net worth of approximately $1 billion to make Forbes 400. I found Bill Gates. I found Warren Buffett. I found Sam Walton's children. But I didn't find you, and I didn't find me. But let's take just a moment and put things in perspective, if you will. There are approximately 6.3 billion people in the world. 2.5, or 40% of those 6.3 billion live in low-income countries where they earn approximately $750 per year. Anybody here want to trade with them? If you happen to live in places like Zimbabwe, Pakistan, Sudan, Kenya, Haiti, or Rwanda, you'll probably, as a family, earn a little less than $500 per year. By the very fact that you and I were born in the United States without doing hardly anything on our own, we are in the top 17% of wealth in the world. And in fact, I'm comfortable in saying everybody assembled here is in the top 10%, and probably the majority assembled here are in the top 5%. Forty percent of the world earns $750 a year or less. The next 43% average $9,200 per year. A little better. You want to trade with them? But not only are we rich financially, and I have to conclude Paul was writing to me and you in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Well, not only are we rich financially, we're rich in educational opportunities. Most of the world would see every one of us as very wealthy. And I think they have every right to view us that way in a material sense. Of the 6 billion people in the world, you are automatically better off than 5.5 of them. We worry about shortages of flu vaccine. The most of the world doesn't even have access to flu vaccines. We worry about our electric bills. Most of the world doesn't even have electricity. We worry about our cars breaking down. Most of the world doesn't even have cars. I believe when Paul said, "You that are rich," he had to telescope ahead and see you and me. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But with it comes a tremendous responsibility, and I believe with it becomes a great dueling conflict in our citizenships. On most of our currency, there are the words, "In God we trust." They first appeared in 1864 on a 2-cent piece. In 1938, all U.S. coins began to bear that inscription. In 1956, Congress declared, "In God we trust," as our national motto. I wonder if that would get passed today. But the question is not, would it get passed today? The question for you and I with our dual citizenship is, do we trust in God, and is that citizenship our priority? I've already said we have responsibilities to our country's citizenship, but it takes and must take second place to our spiritual citizenship. How does this all affect us today? Well, we're familiar with Old Testament stories of how the Israelites, when they were blessed, they'd kind of fade away from God, and then when times would get hard, they would come to the Lord. And the Old Testament is really just has an accordion effect of the Israelites coming and going, coming and going. Well, that's a long time ago. What about us? What about in our century, our lifetime? Richard Nuremberg, in a work entitled Social Sources of Denominationalism, proposes the concept that I agree with him on, that religious groups tend to move from conservative fundamentalism to liberal practices as changes in prosperity leads to changes in their social status. Let me give you an example of that that's not in our lifetime, but it's in our American history. If I were to use the phrase Bible Belt, what geographical area would pop into your mind? Probably the South. We refer to the South somewhat as the Bible Belt. Ever wondered how that came about or why? Well, I don't propose to have all of the answer to that, but let me give you at least part of the answer. In the mid-1800s, in the Civil War, there was not only a winner and a loser militarily, there were winners and losers financially. And most of the Union states, or many of them in those states, prospered during and after the Civil War. And that can be contrasted to the southern states, which not only lost militarily, but also lost very much financially. When the Confederate soldiers went home, they found their homes destroyed, their farms destroyed, they found their rail lines destroyed. Their agrarian economy was in shambles. They were bankrupt. And that can be contrasted with the Union soldiers who went home and over a period of time found jobs. There was an affluency shift, if you will. In the North, children were sent to Ivy League schools dominated by liberal theology that produced liberal preachers and liberal teachers. In the South, they didn't have those financial opportunities to a great extent. Now, obviously, I'm not for or against one of those two groups. I'm just saying it had a tremendous social and religious impact, much like it did on the Israelites. Most of us are now, 150 years later, the products of the Union segment. Not all of us. Culture and prosperity affected religion and spirituality. That's my point. And that's why I think Jesus is able to say it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And I understand he doesn't say it's impossible. He says easier. Today, our prosperity allows us to work fewer hours for more money. It hasn't been that many decades that the concept of retirement was unheard of. You just worked until you died. And I'm not against retirement, done properly. But now we kind of feel cheated if we don't retire before 65. Yesterday, our grandparents worked for necessities. Today, we work for disposable income. And sometimes that disposable income leads to material things that tend to dispose our spiritual hearts. We don't worship wood and stone idols. We worship disposable income and possessions. Not only do I not feel that's better, I think it's more dangerous because it's more elusive. It can be rationalized away. Affluency often, it doesn't have to, but affluency often leads to dissatisfaction with simple worship. And we in the churches of Christ are often criticized because our worship is so simple. Affluency can lead to dissatisfaction in plain teaching, less elegant buildings. Causing us to, if we're not careful, to slowly become indistinguishable from the very religious organizations that we disagree with. Start believing that, does it really matter how you worship? Eventually sliding into pluralism and universalism. You know, one of the great paradoxes of having more affluency is that we become incredibly busy. The very things that ought to give us more time to serve the Lord somehow, in a contorted way, oftentimes cause us to serve Him less. I don't understand that, but add that to the long list. Disposable incomes allows for second homes, third cars, luxurious environments, all of which take maintenance. Affluency turns us into maintenance men. And maintenance men, the more maintenance they have less time to serve the Lord. Affluency makes time demands, or we allow it to make time demands. Many couples follow the great American way. They buy things they don't need with money they don't have from a salesman they don't know to impress people they don't like. Isn't that amazing? But I just described us, if we're not careful. I've shared this with some of you, but those of you that have been married a few years can probably look back on your early years of marriage and with great fondness. And it wasn't a fondness because you had anything. It was really a fondness out of not having anything. All that macaroni you ate. I've shared this with some of you, and Donna's here, and she's a great shopper. In fact, some of you husbands know how good she is. She'll take your wives shopping, and they'll spend money, and she won't. I think that's great. I just love that. She gets a high, and I don't get a bill. We were first married, and I like oatmeal, but she made oatmeal. And probably made a little more of it than we needed. So we had it left over, so I wasn't going to throw that out. That was money. So we put it in the refrigerator. Next day, we heated it up, add a little water. Next day, we heated it up again. By Friday, we had more oatmeal to end than we started with. Those were good times. And they weren't good because we had a lot. They weren't good for you because you had a lot. I'm glad we're a little bit past that. But affluency doesn't make one content and satisfied. Too often it's a time where serving God is replaced by serving our possessions. Even seemingly good activities, our community, our schools, our recreation, Little League, whatever, all good activities, how easy it is for those things to replace our service for God. And that is when our secondary citizenship starts to supersede our primary citizenship. That therein is the problem. Leaving many only managing to attend services once per week and often think little of missing that. What was once acceptable is now acceptable. Why is that? It's often because our secondary citizenship has superseded our primary citizenship. Why all this chasing of things? C.S. Lewis once wrote, "All that we call human history, money, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, classes, empire, slavery, is the long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. And you can't find it. You can find the illusion of happiness, but you can't find happiness. Anytime we have a love for our citizenship of this world and its pleasure, it will invariably crowd out sincere devotion to the Lord." Going to read to you one of Paul's warnings from Romans chapter 8, verses 5 and 6. Romans chapter 8, verse 5 and 6. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. I made a statement at the Eminence campout, and I'm going to make it again. I didn't get a lot of takers at Eminence, and I really didn't want a lot of takers. I just wanted us to think. Would we be better off if gas went to $10 a gallon? Would we be better off if gas went to $10 a gallon? I used that as one of the discussion points in my high school class and junior high class at Eminence, and we spent quite a bit of time, the pros and cons on it. And I'm not advocating that I want that to happen, because I know it could place hardships on many people. My point was, would that slow us down? Would it cause us to quit scurrying from this activity to that activity and spend more time with our families? Would it cause us to spend more time with our brothers and sisters rather than seeing how far we can cat about on our vacations? And there is nothing wrong with that. Don't misunderstand me. But what would a good, healthy dose of slowing down do for us, not simply as a nation, but as a church? Well, some of the young people brought up, well, we wouldn't be able to come to meetings like this. Yeah, you would. Because you do what you want to do. You might eat out three times less than the previous month, so you'd have the gas to get here. But if you wanted to be here, you'd be here. Sure you would. We are the product of our environment. And that's not always good. The story was told of a man walking through a field one day, and he came across an eagle egg. He couldn't put it in the eagle's nest, so he laid it, took it back to his farm, and put it in with the chickens. And a hen laid on that egg, and it hatched. And that little eaglet grew up in a chicken coop. One day that little eaglet, and this is going to tell you that it's a fictitious story because this eaglet can talk, was out and said to the hen that had raised it, it saw a big eagle soaring over. He said, I wish I could do that. And the hen said, you just put that out of your mind. You're a chicken and you'll never be anything more. There was an eaglet who had been convinced it was a chicken. The effect of its environment. You know, if we allow our citizenship in America, as blessed as it is, if we listen to the world and fear man and live our lives out as chickens, and don't put our trust in the Lord, we will never soar like eagles, as Isaiah reminds us to do in the 40th chapter. Now back to Ruth for just a moment. It's Ruth the Moabite, whose voice is the first in the book of Ruth to call on the Lord's name. Wasn't Naomi? After Ruth's resolute declaration of loyalty to her mother-in-law, Ruth adds the following words. May the Lord deal with me, and be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates me and you. Ruth was putting her allegiance to the Lord and Naomi above her citizenship as a Moabite. Further, the irony of Naomi's own distant words, it's a foreigner who has taken Yahweh to be her God and calls him her God accordingly. It's a faithful foreigner, a Moabite, who in Israel is adopted into the Lord's presence and can be traced in blood to the throne of King David, and into the lineage of Christ. You know, it is often in moments where I or you feel most isolated, most displaced by pain, or burdened by the reminder that we're out of place, that we somehow find ourselves most aware of belonging. I do not have to go to Mexico, Aruba, Colombia, Panama, Egypt, or Israel to feel like a foreigner. I can go to Kansas City, Des Moines, St. Louis, Indianapolis, and feel like a foreigner because this is not my world. The psalmist cries with the identity of one who belongs elsewhere. When in Psalms 39 and 12 he says, "Hear my prayer, O Lord, listen to my cry for help. Be not deaf to my weeping, for I dwell with you as an alien, a stranger, as all my fathers were." The whole story of Scripture is a nagging reminder of our homelessness aside from heaven. We have much to be thankful for. Why I'm an American, I don't know. Why I've been so blessed to have been born in this country, I do not know. I am eternally grateful to the Lord if His providential hand allowed that to occur. I'm thankful to my parents for having to live here, whatever. But as grateful and thankful as we all ought to be, rightly so, this world cannot be our home. A couple of months ago, Donna and I were, a movie caught our eye, and it's because I had read about a lady by the name of Gladys Allward. And it was a movie in the late 1950s. Ingrid Bergman starred in it, if I remember right. I don't even remember the title of it. I just remember it was about Gladys Allward. Gladys Allward was a missionary to China during World War II. And to make a real long story very, very short as I close, she ended up heading up an orphanage in China. During World War II, the Japanese were attacking the particular city in which she was in China, and it was her task to lead about 100 children over the mountains, a little bit like Sound of Music, over the mountains to safety. And it was a very stressful thing. Sleepless nights. One morning she got up and had just run out of hope. How can I get these children over the mountain? Pretty much by myself. Multi-day journey. Cold. One of the little girls, a 13-year-old girl in her group, reminded her of a story that Gladys Allward had often told these children. A story of Moses and how he had led the Israelites crossing the Red Sea. And this little girl was trying to reassure Gladys and say, you know, if that can happen, we can make it. Gladys looked at this little girl and said, cried out in desperation, "But I am not Moses." And the little 13-year-old girl looked up at her and said, "Of course you aren't. But God is still God." And thank the Lord that we are citizens of His kingdom. If you have your song books, I'd like for you to turn to 361. "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. Oh Lord, you know, I have no friend like you. If heaven's not my home, then Lord, what will I do? The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore."